content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Greg Cockcroft from the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is The Atlantic. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from The Atlantic magazine. And we begin today with an editorial from the September issue. And this is entitled American Fury by Adrian LaFrance. Convulsions of political violence have a way of imprinting on the national memory. They become, in retrospect, the moments from which the rest of history seems to unspool. Yet they are forever intertwined with the possibility that things could have gone exactly the other way. What if becomes a haunting question. What if Franklin D. Roosevelt's would-be assassin had hit his target in Miami in 1933? What if John F. Kennedy had forgone the convertible ride in Dallas in 1963? What if Martin Luther King Jr. hadn't walked onto the balcony of the Lorraine Motel in Memphis in 1968? What if the bullet that pierced Ronald Reagan's lung in 1981 had been an inch closer to his heart? What if Donald Trump had shifted his weight just before a gunman shot at him during a rally in Pennsylvania in July? What if? Maybe it is the collision of malice and luck that makes the outcome of an attempted assassination seem simultaneously fated and wholly random. But political violence is rarely random. In fact, those who study this subject most assiduously have been warning Americans for years that threats of violence are escalating. Our experience of political violence, the shock of an assassination attempt, how the smallest details suddenly burn bright with meaning, can obscure its true nature. Violence intended to achieve political goals, whether driven by ideology, hatred, or delusions, is broadly predictable. The social conditions that exacerbate it can simmer for years, complex but unmysterious. Again and again throughout history, and indeed today, periods of political violence coincide with ostentatious wealth disparity, faltering trust in democratic institutions, intensifying partisanship, rapid demographic change, and an outpouring of dehumanizing rhetoric about one's political foes, and soaring conspiracy theorizing. Once political violence becomes endemic in society, as it has in ours, it is a terribly difficult to dissolve. Difficult, but not impossible. As I wrote in The New Anarchy in April 2023 cover story for this magazine, political violence is seen as more acceptable today than it was a decade ago by nearly every measure. Political conversation borrows the rhetoric of war. People build their identity not around shared values, but around a hatred of their foes. A 2023 UC Davis survey found that a small but concerning segment of the population considers violence, including lethal violence, to be usually or always justified to advance political objectives. More Americans bring weapons to protests than they did in previous years. A growing number of elected officials face harassment and death threats, which has prompted many capable leaders to drop out of politics entirely. Officials at the highest levels of the military and in the White House told me repeatedly that they believe the United States would see an increase in violent attacks as the 2024 presidential election drew near. Other experts talked about pronounced danger in places where extremist groups had already emerged, where gun culture is thriving, and where hardcore partisans bump up against one another, especially in politically consequential states such as Pennsylvania, Michigan, Wisconsin, Arizona, and Georgia. Clearly, they were right in their warning. They further predicted that the current wave of violence would take a generation or longer to crest. Our informational environment threatens to accelerate outbreaks of violence. Social platforms are optimized for rhetorical warfare. Their algorithms reward emotional outbursts, wild speculation, and unchecked hostility, all of which drive engagement with websites that profit off user attention but profess no real commitment to accuracy. Some of the most powerful people on the planet, the billionaire Elon Musk, various members of Congress, stoke contempt for their political adversaries, real and perceived, and encourage legions of followers to distrust the independent sources of information that try to hold them accountable. Periods of political violence do end, but often not without a shocking retrenchments of people's freedoms or catastrophic events coming first. As I've written previously, governments have a record of responding to political violence brutally and in ways that undermine democratic values and dismantle individual civil liberties. And political leaders are frequently complicit in perpetuating political violence, seeking to harness it for their own ends. I first became interested in political violence around the time of the Waco, Texas massacre in 1993 and the bombing of the Alfred P. Murrah Federal Building in Oklahoma City in 1995. In the years that followed, as the millennium drew to a close, the furies of that particular era appeared to cool, which I took as a sign that something had gone right. One scholar of political violence cautioned against such optimism. The militia movement waned very quickly in the 1990s, not because of anything we did, but because of Oklahoma City. Carolyn Gallagher, who spent 2 years tracking a right-wing paramilitary group in Kentucky, told me, "After the bombing, extremists went underground, but only for a time." William Bernstein, the author of The Delusions of Crowds, put it in chilling terms when I asked him whether he thought January 6th would be a turning point away from violence in American politics. The answer is, and it's not going to be a pleasant answer, the answer is that violence ends if it boils over into a containable cataclysm, he said. What if, he went on, I almost hesitate to say this, but what if the rioters actually had hanged Mike Pence or Nancy Pelosi on January 6th? I think that would have ended it. I don't think it ends without some sort of cathartic cataclysm. I think, absent that, it just boils along for a generation or two generations. These are poisonous days in our nation. It is reasonable to worry that the attempt on Trump's life represents not the end of a cycle of violence, but an escalation in an era that has already seen a congresswoman shot in a supermarket parking lot, a congressman shot while playing baseball, and the U.S. Capitol stormed by insurrectionists. Some degree of cynicism is understandable, but too many Americans are allowing political exhaustion and despair to justify their own abstention from self-governance. Too many believe that screaming into the void or clicking the like button amounts to political involvement. The only way to minimize further bloodshed is to choose leaders at every level of society who reject political violence unconditionally, in word and in deed. This does not mean acquiescing to both-sidism. You can still oppose Trump's authoritarian impulses while condemning the attempt on his life. Making it through this dark time does, however, require articulating American values worth preserving and building consensus toward reaching them. And it requires understanding the deleterious effects of political violence. Bloodshed begets more bloodshed, and a functioning democracy can only withstand so much of it. There are no random acts of political violence in America or anywhere else. There will be violence in our nation until Americans come together to say, enough. Adrian LaFrance is the executive editor of The Atlantic magazine. Our second article today from the family section. How snacks took over American life. The rhythms of our days may never be the same. By Alan Cushing. There was a time, if you can believe it, when a respectable person could not have had a little treat whenever she wanted. This time was roughly from the dawn of the Republic to the middle of the 1980s. The American workday, menu, and social clock were oriented around meals, and eating between them was discouraged. If you were a child, snacking gave you cavities and spoiled your appetite. If you were an adult, it was kind of unseemly. There were no elaborate treats after soccer practice, or snack trays on strollers, or tubes of yogurt. Energy bars were for athletes, not accountants. National parks did not have vending machines. Grocery stores did not have aisles and aisles of portable abundance. The phrases girl dinner and new flavor drop were totally nonsensical, instead of just a bit nonsensical. Libraries, classrooms, cubicles, and theaters were, generally, where you read, learned, worked, and saw La Boheme, but definitely did not eat. Some 40 years later, we are not just eating between meals, we are abandoning them entirely. In the 3 decades leading up to 2008, the average American doubled their daily snack intake, and the percentage of adults snacking on any given day rose from 59% to 90%, according to a comprehensive government report. In the most recent iteration of the same study, which ended in 2020 before the pandemic, that number rose again to 95%. More than half of respondents said they consumed at least 3 snacks a day. According to a survey released earlier this year by the international snack food conglomerate Mondelez International, in conjunction with the Harris Poll, 6 in 10 consumers preferred snacking over traditional meals. The trend will probably persist. Younger people are significantly more likely than older ones to report skipping meals, choosing instead to cobble together a day's worth of sustenance piece by piece away from the table. Snacks won. Andrea Hernandez, a former forecaster who runs a Substack newsletter about the topic, told me. Our parents used to tell us, don't snack or you'll ruin the meal. And now the snack has become the whole meal. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner, once our national metronome, have gone from expected to optional. America's eating life has been reoriented under our nose, remolded for a world that is very different from how it used to be. Snacking and snack foods have existed since long before the 3-day meal came to dominate, but the moment we are living through can trace its origins to the late 1970s and early 80s, when cultural and economic trends collided to kick off a snack boom that never abated. The Reagan administration loosened restrictions on television advertising, so cartoon characters could much more easily show sugary cereals on Sunday mornings. New nutrition research and recently fitness-crazed culture decided snacking was healthful and rebranded it grazing. The grocery industry consolidated, Janice Thiessen, a history professor in the University of Winnipeg, told me, which meant that stores once supplied by small regional manufacturers were now working with national and international snack food companies with bigger advertising budgets and generally lower prices. At the same time, people began having less time to spend in the kitchen. Women, particularly married ones, joined the workforce in droves. Kids were more likely to be home alone after school, or, if they were wealthy, at one of the extracurricular activities that had sprung up to keep them occupied and get them into college. Parents started encouraging snacking to ensure children ate enough during the day that had suddenly become busier for everyone. The car cup holder was introduced, along with a minivan, in 1983. Drive-throughs soared in popularity. As American families traded time for money, the snack food sector found new ways to meet their demands, turning out new and more tempting products faster than ever, as Abigail Carroll, writes in Three Squares, her history of meals. In the 1960s and 70s, about 250 new high-calorie snack foods were added to shelves every year. By the end of the 80s, that figure was closer to 2,000. By the mid-90s, just about everything an American kid could make for herself after school had been snackified. Pizza, bagels had become bagel bites. Peanut butter sandwiches had become Uncrustables. And packaged snacks had become an indelible symbol of childhood. You go to other countries and it'll be like, "Oh, my comfort food is this soup my mom makes," Hernandez says. And for American millennials, it'll be like, "Oh my God, man, that Dunkaroos, that Funfetti one." When the children raised on snacks grew up, snacks became part of young adulthood. Companies, first in the young skewing tech industry, and then in white-collar work more broadly, began providing employees with snacks as a perk. When my mother started her first office job in the 70s, eating at work was inappropriate. 50 years later, her daughter wrote much of this article in the company of a little ramekin of mini Reese's Pieces, provided by her employer, which she ate out of the palm of her hand like a pigeon. Every generation thinks it is the center of the universe. Millennials actually are, at least from a market segmentation perspective. "We're like the apex consumer right now," Hernandez said, speaking for her age group and mine. "We have disposable income and mouths to feed. We are old enough to eat whatever we want. We want snacks. And we are still being pushed toward them by a massive industrial mechanism with an existential interest in keeping us eating all the time. Snack foods tend to be made with inexpensive ingredients such as corn, soy, and potatoes, and sold at a heavy markup. They are the cheap solution to a fundamental problem for the food industry. Companies are expected to grow, but human bodies can take in only so much. Snacks are designed by geniuses using advanced technology, with the express intention of powering past our feelings of satiety and making us eat more. They are designed to be eaten anywhere and built using flavor and texture combinations that our basic neurological functions simply cannot get enough of. Salt, fat, sweet, crunch, chew, cream. Nutritional science has a word for this: palatability. Though in recent years, the field has been forced to invent a new one: hyperpalatability. One way to get people to buy more food is to make it taste better. Another is to expand the rationale for eating in the first place, to turn it into something we do for fun, not just sustenance. This is where we are now. Thanks to developments in manufacturing and packaging, it's never been cheaper to make new flavors of snacks. And thanks to social media, it's never been more remunerative. Oreos were invented in 1912. And they remain more or less unsullied for decades. In the 90s, the company might have released a limited edition or Christmas flavor, to little fanfare, the snack historian Jason Leidig told me. Thus, this year so far, Mondelez has released 12 new flavors. Each yields a wave of taste test TikToks, Instagram posts, and coverage in the entertainment press that previously reserved such space for articles about movie releases and new albums. Mondelez's revenues increased nearly 40% from 2018 to 2023. We have entered the age of snacking as fandom, in which, as my colleague Megan Garber has written, the abilities of the chemist collide with the demands of the influencer culture. Snacks are everywhere we want to eat, and so everything is becoming snacks. John Harvey Kellogg was a Seventh-day Adventist and a sanatorium doctor who thought that bland, sugar-free breakfast cereal could solve America's ills. The company he co-founded in 1906 now makes the majority of its sales from highly processed, highly flavorful, highly sugary snacks. Last month, Mars bought the snack food division of Kellogg's for $36 billion, the largest acquisition of the year so far. I recently came across a bag of pesto-flavored potato puffs, billed as pasta chips. Dinner quite literally refashioned into a snack. Pasta should be at your fingertips anytime, anywhere, the copy on the back of the bag reads. Olives, pickles, apples, salad, jam, and peanut butter have all been packaged in plastic and marketed as snacks. You don't need a table. You don't need utensils. You just have to have it in your hand, Hernandez told me. Everything is now in convenient form, even stuff that wasn't that inconvenient to begin with. The shift towards snacking reflects great disruptions in American life. It has also created them. In the time that snacks have taken over, cooking has declined further. The rules around food have become much more casual. We are much less likely to eat with other people, if we even have a dining table to eat at, and much more likely to eat in cars. Eating has become less deferential to propriety and more tuned to personal pleasure. Meals may require us to set the table, make concessions to what our companions want, and at the least gesture at balance. Snacks, generally, do not. And all of the factors that facilitated snacks' rise four decades ago have become only more pronounced. Americans are working longer hours than people in other developed countries. Kids are running from activity to activity. Robert Byrne, a market researcher at the food service research and consulting firm Technomic, told me that people are significantly more likely now than ever before to make food decisions based on feeling pressed for time. People's lives are so complicated. Thiessen, the University of Winnipeg professor, told me, everyone has to cram eating in where they can, and they have a much larger array of options to choose from when they do. That doesn't seem likely to change. You cannot unlearn convenience, Hernandez said. You cannot ungrant what Carol, the Three Squares author, calls the inherently American freedom to snack at whim, or unpopularize what the internet calls little treat culture. Snacks are ingrained in American life, in our brain, our cupboards, our menus, the rhythms of our days. No one will ever pry them out of our salty, sticky hands. Next, as a counterpoint to the American Fury editorial that we first heard, An Ode to America by James Parker, another staff writer for The Atlantic. Pretty good nose you got there. You do much fighting with that nose? New Orleans, 1989. I'm standing on a balcony south of the Garden District, and a man, a stranger, is hailing me from the street. He looks like Paul Newman. If Paul Newman were an alcoholic house painter. I don't, as it happens, do much fighting with this nose, but that's not the point. The point is that something about me, the particular young man way I'm jutting into the world, physically, attitudinally, beak first, is being recognized. The actual contour of me, or so I feel, is being saluted for the first time. America, this is personal. I came to you as a cramped and nervous Brit, an overwhelmed piece of English clockwork, and you laid your cities before me. The alcoholic house painter gave me a job, and it worked out pretty much as you might expect, given that I had never painted houses before, and he was an alcoholic. Nonetheless, I was at large. I was in American space. I could feel it spreading away unsteadily on either side of me, raw innocence, potential harm, beckoning peaks, buzzing ions of possibility, and threading through it in and out of range, fantastic, dry bones laughter. No safety net anywhere, but rather, if I could only adjust myself to it, if I could be worthy of it, a crackling, sustained buoyancy. I blinked, and the baggage of history fell off me. Neuroses rolled down the hill. It rolled back up later, but that's another story. America, it's true what they say about you, all the good stuff. I'd be allowed to do something here. I'd be encouraged to do something here. It would be demanded of me in the end that I do something here. Later that year, I'm in San Francisco, ripping up the carpets in someone's house. Sweaty work. Fun work, if you don't have to do it all the time. I love the unzipping sound of a row of carpet tacks popping out of a hardwood floor. On our lunch break, my co-ripper and I gaze at the city skyline, at the rippling spires, the dewy pavilions of San Francisco, and I say something about how good I'm feeling. He turns to me. Man, you should get paid just for that. They should pay you just for walking around the city with your head up. Only in America, believe me, do people say things like this. So listen, right now, your space, your beautiful space, your ungovernable American ether is going bloody haywire. No denying it. The imagination that big bangs you into being every morning is unwell. It's time to reroute all the noble energies of yours, redirect them with a noise like the drums of Elvin Jones as he explodes behind John Coltrane. Perturbed country, heal yourself. I know you can, because in the wildness of your generosity, you once healed me. We've run out of time for today's episode of The Atlantic. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Greg Cockcroft, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The Atlantic is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.